In 1928, The Well of Loneliness was published and immediately banned because of its lesbian content. In the first of a two-part programme, the writer Val McDermott examines the history of the lesbian novel over the intervening 80 years. She'll be asking how books with a lesbian theme gained wider acceptance, becoming bestsellers and award winners in the process. From The Ban to The Booker includes contributions from some of Britain's finest writers, including Sarah Waters, Ali Smith and Jeanette Winterson.
I don't want to write books for people who are gay. I don't want to read books about people who are gay. I want to write books that are for all of us in any situation. It would be really like saying to me, listen, Jeanette, you know, the only thing that could have spoken to you was books about, you know, miserable northern working class kids with mad Pentecostal parents growing up without any books. No. What I wanted was quite the opposite of that. I wanted the space that said there are other worlds and you can have them.
Here we are in a major chain bookshop. 3 for 2. Buy one, get one half price. You might be forgiven for thinking that's not the best starting point to fill your shopping bag with lesbian fiction. Let's make a start with the award winners. Jeanette Winterson's Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, winner of the Whitbread. Sarah Waters' Affinity, winner of the Somerset Maugham and the Sunday Times Young Writer of the Year. Ali Smith's The Accidental, winner of the Whitbread for Best Novel. You only have to look at the bestseller lists. Manda Scott, Sarah Waters and Patricia Cornwell head the charge. Now, even if every lesbian in the country was buying a copy of each of these books once a month, it still wouldn't account for the sales figures or the critical acclaim. The only explanation is that the wider reading public has learned to love lesbian writing. More books to add to the to-be-read pile. The first question is a complicated one, masquerading as a simple one. What exactly do we mean by a lesbian novel? Does it have to have some unequivocal girl-on-girl action, no matter how tame? Can it be encoded, so that only the initiated understand what's going on? Do you have to be a lesbian to write one? And can you write one without even realising it? Is it a matter of substance or sensibility? Jeanette Winterson famously dislikes the terms lesbian and author in the same sentence.
I hate labels, and it seems to me that the purpose of art in any media, but particularly literature, is to get us away from preconceptions, from assumptions, from ideas about who we are and what we know, into an imaginative, open territory. It's about that process of change, a kind of alchemy, which takes place. And so, of course, to decide at the beginning exactly what's going to take place, that it is this sort of a book, or it's for that sort of reader, or this is what it will be about, you know, stick a label on it. I find utterly depressing and dispiriting.
Here we are then.
Oh wow, this is lovely. Fantastic light.
Yeah, it's a good room to work in.
It's great, yeah. Sarah Waters' novels have been garlanded with prizes and award nominations. She's twice been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize with Fingersmith and The Night Watch. And the TV adaptations of her work have opened a window on lesbian life unlike any other.
Mad Woman in the Attic.
Do you think that the sexuality of an author influences the way that they write? That even if what they write about doesn't have an obvious lesbian theme, I know it sounds a bit mad, but do you think you can tell an author's sexuality from their prose?
I think you can a bit, you know, and I think as lesbian and gay readers, we've probably all had that experience of, you know, the sort of gaydar thing, that something about a book or a film sets off your gaydar and you're not quite sure what it is, that's just a little something. And I think, you know, the label a lesbian novel is a very flexible one. I mean, obviously there's somebody like me, you know, an out lesbian writer writing out lesbian fiction, that's clear to me. Yes, it's lesbian fiction. But then you take a writer like Daphne du Maurier, for example, about whom only relatively recently, really, have we discovered the extent of her, you know, lesbian affairs. And then you begin to look at a novel like Rebecca, which is really a novel about marriage on the surface. But when you think about Daphne's life, and you realise that actually, you know, the fascinations in that novel are all between the second Mrs. De Winter and the first. It's the figure of Rebecca is this sort of desirable, frightening, dangerous kind of female figure sort of looming right over the book.
Nothing about me is very important, I hope, in the way I write and what I write, and at the same time it's unavoidable. I mean, we can't avoid our biographies, I can't avoid where I come from and who I am, and those things are going to accompany me in anything I do all the way through my life. But it's not the thing you think about when you sit down, you know, to write something. The thing you think about when you sit down is, what's that voice, where is it going, I have to be listening for it, I have to be true to it.
It's hard to resist Ali Smith's analysis. However hard we try to deny our biographies, they inevitably inform what we write. Our books may leap into the imaginative unknown, as Jeanette Winterson reminds us they should, but they're still rooted in who we are and what has happened to us. It's hard to come up with a definition of what constitutes a lesbian novel, but whatever else it is, it's light years away from what it was 80 years ago when Radcliffe Hall's The Well of Loneliness was published and promptly banned for obscenity. It's the one novel that most lesbians have read, or at least dipped into before being stunned by the dullness of its prose. I first read The Well of Loneliness when I was 18. I was an undergraduate at Oxford, struggling to figure out why I felt so different from everyone around me. I thought it was something to do with being Scottish or wanting to be a writer. There was no template for the way I felt. No visible lesbians anywhere. Not in the soaps, not on the bookshelves, and certainly not in my emotionally buttoned-up Oxford college. I really had no idea about lesbians. Mind you, after reading The Well of Loneliness, I wasn't that much further forward.
So this is a lovely edition of The Well of Loneliness that I found in a junk shop, I think. 35 cents, Perma Books. I guess it's from the 60s, an American sort of pulp.
How could they make The Well of Loneliness look that racy?
I know, anxious, busty-looking girls on the front. It's great. I read The Well of Loneliness for the first time when I was about 21 or 22. And I remember taking it home to my parents' house, because I must have been home from college or something, and my dad picking it up and kind of reading the back. And this was way before I'd come out to my parents, and I could see him looking slightly intrigued and slightly anxious about about what the back of the novel was saying. And I remember reading it and being interested in it more than sort of touched by it, because it didn't seem to say much about me, you know, my experiences of lesbianism. It felt like a real period piece to me at that point, even though I think I knew already that it had been an iconic book for lots of women. It felt a bit mawkish, you know, a bit daft, actually.
Have you seen it?
It's a veritable house.
Really? I'm here in Highgate Cemetery at the grave of Radcliffe Hall with Diana Suami, who wrote The Trials of Radcliffe Hall. We're walking up through what would be a woodland trail if it wasn't flanked on either side by memorials and grave markers and angels and obelisks. And suddenly, amongst all these doors leading off into who knows what, we come across the plaque that says Radcliffe Hall, 1943. And there, by the sort of greening door, a vase of fresh flowers, only been there a couple of days by the looks of it, some of them not even properly opened, and a little potted cyclamen. So, since 1943, her memory's still green. Certainly the flowers are still green. Could you just give us a brief outline of the plot of The Well of Loneliness?
Stephen Gordon, that's the heroine, her father Sir Philip wanted a son and is terribly disappointed that this broad-shouldered, thin-hipped congenital sexual invert comes out.
And the child is not as other girls.
That's right. And in fact, Stephen Gordon then proceeds to have a horrible time. She then has an affair with a married woman, Angela Crosby, I think the woman's name is. But Angela goes back to her cad of her husband. Then she goes off and fights in the First World War and drives an ambulance and gets scarred by a piece of shrapnel and falls in love with Mary, who's also doing something in the First World War. Shall I hurry it along? Then it ends up with, oh, and that night they were not divided. That actually happens with her and Mary.
Then Stephen must tell her the cruel truth. She must say, I am one of those whom God marked on the forehead. Like Cain, I'm marked and blemished. If you come to me, Mary, the world will abhor you, will persecute you, will call you unclean. Our love may be faithful even unto death and beyond, yet the world will call it unclean. Stephen bent down and kissed Mary's hands very humbly. For now she could find no words any more. And that night they were not divided.
And then she hands Mary over to Martin so that Mary can go off with Martin, and she loses all round. So it's a loser story, to tell you the truth.
I mean, I wonder sometimes when I look at the sort of synopsis of The Well of Loneliness whether one of the things that Radcliffe Hall did in terms of lesbian literature was give us a template for the miserable ending. Because it seemed for so long that you had to have a terrible ending in a lesbian novel. You know, somebody had to kill themselves or lose their lover or something like that. You know, there's a lot of dead lesbians that scattered our literature.
Yes, but that was brought up in the actual trial, that it had to be a horrible state, because what were these creatures? They were nasty perverts.
When she wrote The Well of Loneliness, Radcliffe Hall had no idea what she was letting herself in for. By the time it was published in 1928, she was already a best-selling and prize-winning author. It didn't occur to her that she was putting her career on the line. She saw it as her mission to write a book in defence of lesbians, or, as she called us, congenital sexual inverts, CSI for short. She thought her reputation would be enough to protect her from society's prejudices. Of course, in the upper-class circles she moved in, she really had no idea how scandalous her book would appear. And what were those initial reactions to it? What were the reviews like?
The reviews were mixed. Nobody said it was disgusting, awful, filth. People thought it was a bit boring and long and worthy. Nobody seemed particularly disturbed by it. It seemed all to be going well.
Just when you think it's safe to get back in the water, enter the Sunday Express. James Douglas, the paper's editor, got on his high horse and rode out against the book. He wrote to Radcliffe Hall's publisher, Jonathan Cape, and warned him to look out for that weekend's editorial. Douglas wanted The Well of Loneliness to be withdrawn from sale, and he wasn't afraid to say why.
Its theme is utterly inadmissible in the novel. I am well aware that sexual inversion and perversion are horrors which exist among us today. They flaunt themselves in public places with increasing effrontery, and more insolently provocative bravado. We must protect our children against their specious fallacies and sophistries. Therefore, we must banish their propaganda from our bookshops and libraries. I would rather give a healthy boy or a healthy girl a phial of prussic acid than this novel. Poison kills the body, but moral poison kills the soul.
Here is where the plot really begins. The Home Secretary, Joynson Hicks, who was known as the preposterous Jix, was a evangelical moralist and knew filth when he saw it. He immediately started the wheels turning that this was a book that must go. He had met in the Garrick Club with James Douglas. They were all in cahoots. It all happened way beyond the time of the book getting to court.
And this is where it turns into a frenzied silent movie. A Keystone Cops scenario, where the captions would read thus. Jonathan Cape makes an extra set of printing moulds for the book. He sneaks them to Paris, where the book is printed. It's smuggled back into England. The publicity means it flies off the shelves, but nothing can stop the British establishment in full cry. Customs are ordered to seize the books. The head of customs himself refuses, crying, "Never! No book should be banned simply because we don't like its subject matter." But the police aren't so squeamish. They raid the offices of Jonathan Cape himself, confiscate the Parisian copies there, et voila. The scene was set for a show trial, presided over by the chief magistrate himself. And just to make sure the result was the right one, he didn't bother with a jury. At the trial itself, the defence weren't allowed to call any witnesses, is that right?
That's absolutely right. They all sat there. The courtroom was packed. They were all rather dreading having to go into the witness box. But no one was called because the chief magistrate said that their views would be opinion, and opinions were inadmissible evidence.
How did Radcliffe react to all of this? I mean, it must have been very bizarre for her. I mean, I can imagine as a writer, having this sort of thing going on would completely do your head in.
She was greatly agitated. I mean, she was beside herself, and she had lunch with her defence counsel, who then started blustering that the book wasn't about sex at all.
wasn't about sex between women, it was only an intellectual exercise or something, and she at lunch gave him hell and said he'd got to go back there and say it was about sex between women. She did actually shout out at one point in court, "I am the author of this book, this is shameful," and was told she'd be removed from the court if she did that again. I think it ruined her life, really, because she did actually leave England, and she, you see, she was right-wing, she was a Tory, this was her class. She was litigious, she thought that the law should be an instrument of justice and right, and should, or actually, because she was the spokesperson for justice and right, should come down on her side. So the whole thing was very, very punishing for her.
And so instead of becoming someone who was admired and respected for her courage, she really became the butt of jokes.
Which she couldn't stand. She simply couldn't stand. There was a publication, a spoof called The Sink of Solitude. It was in rhyming couplets. And The Well of Loneliness is a dreadful title. I mean, what could be more glum?
Is that the worst book ever written? It must be. It does make me laugh. It's so terrible, isn't it? Everything about it is terrible. I mean, Jesus, it's enough to make a girl straight. And it was the incredible thing about 1928 is in that year is that The Well of Loneliness came out and was immediately banned in that rather dramatic and flamboyant way. And, of course, Orlando came out, which became Virginia Woolf's bestseller, and is much more outrageous and audacious. Cross-gender, cross-dressing, same-sex love.
The sound of the trumpets died away, and Orlando stood stark naked. No human being since the world began has ever looked more ravishing. His form combined in one, the strength of a man and a woman's grace. As he stood there, the silver trumpets prolonged their note, as if reluctant to leave the lovely sight which their blast had called forth. Orlando looked himself up and down in a long looking-glass, without showing any signs of discomposure, and went, presumably, to his bath. We may take advantage of this pause in the narrative to make certain statements. Orlando had become a woman. There is no denying it.
Everything in her, but done with such bounce and such style and such wit and such audacity that she completely gets away with it, whereas dreary old Radcliffe Hall, you know, and as Virginia Woolf said, you know, any amount of filth could be hidden in there because it was so impenetrable nobody would ever want to read it.
I think it was made pretty clear in the recently published extracts from Virginia Woolf's diary that the idea of her book, Orlando, was inspired by her own strange conception of myself and my family, and Noel, my family home.
26 years after Orlando was published, Vita Sackville-West spoke publicly about the book she inspired. Orlando has often been described as the longest love letter in English literature. I read it not long after The Well of Loneliness, not because I'd heard it was a lesbian book, but because it was on my English literature syllabus. I had no idea what I was getting into. But Orlando resonated in my head and my heart in a way that The Well of Loneliness had signally failed to do. If this was what it meant to be a lesbian, I was definitely up for it. In an interview with the BBC in 1954, Vita describes how she first found out that Virginia was working on it.
The first letter is dated October the 9th, 1927. It startled me considerably. Yesterday morning I was in despair. You know that bloody book which Dede and Leonard extort drop by drop from my breast, fiction or some title to that effect. I couldn't screw a word from me, and at last dropped my head in my hands, dipped my pen in the ink, and wrote these words, as if automatically, on a clean sheet, Orlando, a biography. I think she really enjoyed writing this book, and that it caused her less agony than many of the others. It represented her high spirits, her sense of humour, her sense of sheer fun.
You might think of Orlando as a precursor of a certain sort of magic realism. For one thing, the transformation from male to female is sort of quasi-fantastical.
Professor Gabrielle Griffin from York University is the author of Who's Who in Lesbian and Gay Writing. So how did Virginia Woolf get away with it? A protagonist who romps through 400 years of history, changes sex halfway along, and sails in and out of relationships with men and women, and not a single newspaper editor or magistrate getting hot under the collar.
in the identity that Orlando has, either as male or female, there is never any ambiguity about that identity per se. It is written in a much more experimental and modernist style. This means that certain kinds of audiences, you know, one might say Sunday Express readers like the ones that were addressed in the initial accusations around the Well of Loneliness, would not have been the obvious audience for this kind of text.
The reaction to The Well of Loneliness was a pretty parochial affair. Across the water in Paris, amazing things were happening. Writers of the calibre of Gertrude Stein and Juna Barnes were all publishing books with lesbian content. Some of it was subtle, it's true, but much of it was entirely unequivocal. However, these were all clever books, aimed at intellectuals rather than the common reader, so they escaped the attention of the censors. It seems that if you had brains enough, you didn't have to be protected. You could be expected to resist the siren song of the congenital sexual inverts.
It strikes me as interesting that in 1928, the year that The Well of Loneliness came out, there was a whole spate of really interesting novels about lesbians, some a bit encoded, some less encoded, by major writers. I'm thinking, of course, of Virginia Woolf's Orlando, Compton Mackenzie's Extraordinary Women, Elizabeth Bowen's novel, The Hotel. That year was sort of the apogee of lesbian literature for a while, and in England, in any case, as a result of the Radcliffe Hall trial, things got quiet.
Lillian Federman is the author of Chloe plus Olivia, an anthology of lesbian literature from the 17th century to the present.
For instance, there's a 1931 novel by a British writer by the name of Sheila Donisthorpe. It's called The Loveliest of Friends. Sheila Donisthorpe could not find a publisher in Great Britain. The novel was published only in America in 1931, and I think that really had a lot to do with the British trial around the Well of Loneliness.
What happened to Radcliffe Hall and her book made people nervous. No writer or publisher wanted to face a trial like that, or the public humiliation that went with it. The message was clear. Get into the closet, stay there, and shut up. You might get away with it if your book was experimental, intellectual, and not too gender-specific, but really, who needs the aggravation?
Just last week her boyfriend had her in a whirl. That romance is over, she's dropped him for a girl.
With the looming spectre of Radcliffe Hall's fate, the 1930s was a lean time for lesbian literature in Britain. The notable exception is Sylvia Townsend Warner. She was already well known. She'd had big successes with novels like Lolly Willows and Mr. Fortune's Maggot. What the overwhelming majority of her public didn't know was that she lived with her lover, Valentine Ackland. Frances Bingham is the editor of a collection of Ackland's poetry, Journey from Winter.
One of the books Sylvia Townsend Warner published in this period was Summer Will Show, which came out in 1936. And in her diary, Valentine describes this as Sylvia's lesbian novel. The story is quite a simple one, in a sense. An aristocratic Englishwoman called Sophie. Her husband, Frederick, goes off with a French woman, his mistress, and goes to Paris. She pursues them and she ends up with the mistress. And there isn't explicit sex in it, but I think that there are passages in it that make it very clear that it's a sexual relationship between the two women. For example, here, Minna entered. "You slept," she said, and holding Sophia's hand, she gazed at her with a possessive, earnest glance, a glance that instantly recalled the taste of the mulled wine offered overnight. "I cannot understand," thought Sophia, "what Frederick could see in you, but I can see a great deal."
So here, for example, is The Night Watch in German, Die Frauen von London.
Oh.
A nice cover there.
That's very nice.
I mean, you said yourself, I think, in the past that by the 30s and the 40s, the time you're writing about A Night Watch, the world had moved forward since the time of The Well of Loneliness. Can you be specific, really, about the ways in which that had changed and why it changed?
Well,
One of the things that The Well of Loneliness and its trial did, of course, was to advertise lesbianism, just in a way I think that Oscar Wilde's trial had done for gay men, you know, in the 1890s. For example, in the 30s, you know, when I was doing academic research into lesbian writing, there was a real flurry of literary interest in lesbianism in the 30s. There were, you know, biographies of Queen Christina of Sweden and Sappho, and there were a lot of other sort of lesbian themes creeping into fiction. So by the 40s and 50s, lesbians and gay men were a lot more visible, I think, than they'd been in the earlier part of the century.
There are a number of texts that explore same-sex relationships between women, but they do so often in a kind of way that does pathologize. A good example is Dorothy Cowlin's Winter Solstice, which was published in 1943. We have a girl who suffers from hysterical paralysis and lives with her brothers who are tailors. One day into the tailor's shop comes this aviator woman, and she falls madly in love with this woman, and her hysterical paralysis vanishes. The whole thing has a denouement, which is rather disappointing because they don't get together at the end of the story. I wrote an introduction to it, and she avidly denied that there was any lesbian content. We see this quite a lot when we do research on women working in the periods from, let's say, the 1920s to the 1950s, that their self-definition and the definition of their work is at odds with how we today would interpret that.
By 1949, British society had changed enough for The Well of Loneliness to be republished. It's undeniably a book that polarises opinion. Some admire Radcliffe Hall's courage and tenacity without reservation. Others are completely horrified by the book's prose and its message. But there's no question that she did what nobody else at the popular end of the literary world was willing to do. She stuck her neck out.
There are people who feel that she was a trailblazer, which I think, in a curious sense, she was. I think that what she really did dare do was to change pronouns, you know, and to say she kissed her on the lips. She dared do it. Mm-hmm. Whether she did it adroitly or adeptly is to be questioned. But she has got an evangelical sense of this is what you should be allowed to say.
As the 1940s turned into the 1950s, a new and peculiar wave of lesbian fiction arrived, with titles like The Depraved One, The Damned One, and Satan Was a Lesbian. They weren't for the faint-hearted. In next week's programme, I'll be talking about lesbian pulp fiction and explaining how books with lesbian storylines and characters became part of the mainstream.
I'm crazy for trying, and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you.
From the Band to the Booker was presented by Val McDermott, and the programme was produced in Manchester by Nicola Swords.